Welcome to Indigenous Action, where we dig deep into critical issues impacting our communities throughout occupied North America.
This is an autonomous anti-colonial broadcast with unapologetic and claws-out analysis towards total liberation.
So take your seat by this fire, and may the bridges we burn together light our way.
Part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network, channelzero.com.
Hello, hello, this is Bearcat. Welcome to the Indigenous Action Podcast. Today we have our guest, Amanda Lickers. I am co-hosting today with our other regular host, Klee. We'll be restructuring our podcast a little bit, and so we'll hopefully be giving you some new things to think about and make things a little bit easier to listen to and to engage with for our audience members. I'm Bearcat. I'm Shoshone and Paiute, and I live in the so-called Southwest America, so-called Americas. And I'd like to welcome our guest today, Amanda Lickers, a real badass coming to us from, well, you know what? I'm not even going to attempt the name. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
So my name is Yigotsarari Amanda Lickers. I'm a Seneca of Six Nations of the Grand River, living here in Joni Jochage, beautiful Ganyagahaga territory in the sovereign Mohawk Nation. Happy to be representing the Haudenosaunee Confederacy here, you know, as a community member. And it's always fun to get with other troublemakers. Yeah, I use she and they, two-spirit, queer, anti-authoritarian, and that kind of stuff. So yeah, just Nyala, thank you so much for hosting me today.
Yate, this is Klee, and welcome. It's so great to reconnect with you. I'm really excited about the conversation today. Today's show, we're focusing on climate justice, colonialism, green capitalism, and land trauma. And this will be put out on what is recognized as Earth Day or marked as Earth Day, which has always rubbed me the wrong way that, you know, settler colonizers just set aside one day to honor the Earth. But that's not a new critique. We, to just get right into it, you know, our first question for you is that critiques of climate justice are not new, and you're no stranger to them. There's a video floating around out there of you confronting 350.org's Bill McKibben directly about colonialism and capitalist violence, which is awesome. So I recommend people to check that out online. You know, you've challenged white supremacy, capitalism, colonialism within the climate justice movement for years. And the main question I have for you right now is what, if anything, has changed as you've seen this movement shift?
Yeah, I mean, if get your antidepressants ready, like this is not going to be positive. I mean, it's hard to say. Like, I think, you know, like a post Standing Rock context is very bleak. It's just like the machine has gotten better. Everything has become just so much more disconnected from grassroots movements. And even what is a grassroots movement has almost shifted in its definition. There's NGOs in everything. Co-optation is so fast. It's like, it's to the point where, and it's also disheartening because, like you said, these critiques of things like the People's Climate March, this is not new. We've been doing this for 10 years at least, and people before us for 20, 30, 40, however many years, like our ancestors for generations have been holding down these front lines. So why do we have to continuously try to re-educate and interrupt the brainwashing with every new generation? Okay, guess what? You know, NGOs, it is just one side of the coin of the settler state. Their job is to broker deals between industry and government and cut out Indigenous people time and time again. And it's very sad. And it's not just limited to this kind of sellout vibes. It's also in, you know, on the front lines and the rape culture and patriarchy and cis heteronormativity that exists in the streets and makes it actually unsafe for people to be able to call out with dissent and dissenting voices. Critical thinking is seen as divisive and lateral violence. And when we speak to the systemic, you know, the systemic violences we're experiencing, hey, this is how white supremacy is coded as a system. Oh, well, you're just being divisive. It's the exact same critique that we've been making, you know, and it's actually sad now because in the beginning of the 2010s, there was still the leftover of the anti-globalization movement. And there was still that kind of spirit of rioting, you know, like, where the hell are the riots? Like, it's just come get your blimp, come get your flag, come get your photo with Justin Trudeau at the head of the climate march and go work for an NGO. That's it. There is no climate justice movement.
Hey, Amanda, tell us how you really feel.
Right? It's like there's only an Indigenous sovereignty movement. That's it.
Oh, man. I feel you so much on all of it. And yeah, it is pretty disheartening, but it's good to hear, I guess, to relate to other people who are also, you know, in the mud with us and agree and see all this shit, too. It's like we're not just imagining it. We're not, you know, being, you know, any kind of way. That's what it really is. So, what are some of the implications and consequences that you see that come along with things like greenwashing and green capitalism? Now that we're talking a little bit more about our more contemporary struggles and the directions that we're going, and the newer, I guess, front lines that we're seeing that are, you know, basically just a repetition of the old. But what are some of the implications that you see?
I think one of the things that I feel like just is not hitting home when it comes to like the way that greenwashing is morphing into, okay, sustainable energy, renewable energy, like continue the settler project. Like settler colonialism is not sustainable. There is no greenwashing genocide. And so when the system is still based in exploitation of peoples and lands as resources, when peoples and lands are seen as resources, then we're not getting anywhere. And I think what is happening is just an incredibly effective system linked to globalization that is assimilating our energy and our movements into the status quo. And with that, you know, it's like, I think we're going to talk about this later around tactics, but even, you know, the reality is that what is left of the grassroots is now, unless you're on a front line that's based in sovereignty, like based in, you know, in indigenous sovereignty and like land back struggles directly, part of those historical and contemporary movements, I feel that campaign to campaign style organizing is not working. We're just raising a lot of money to hand over to the state for bail and putting people in harm's way just to deal with an epidemic of mental health and a lack of resources and support, putting people in the teeth of the state to be chewed out and spit away, to be targeted for COINTELPRO, to have their lives ripped away from them. And, you know, and at the same time, you know, 350.org, Greenpeace, Honor the Earth, whoever you want to say, you know, they're making money off of this. They're building media campaigns, and they're part of a larger capitalist system that will benefit. And so for me, I feel like we need to stop setting people up to just be like kidnapped, basically. We got to stop, because there are better ways to do it that are not on social media. And for example, like a historical example that it is safe to talk about is like 2013, Elsibuktuk, Mi'kmaq territory. You know, they were fighting anti-fracking resistance, fighting Texas-based SWN. And, you know, they took grassroots approaches, and they didn't do showy lockdowns where there's a bunch of media and there's 30 people getting arrested and a bunch of cops coming. What happened was, you know, equipment was being destroyed. A lot of equipment was being destroyed, and it was being chalked up to the beavers, man. It was on some secret society shit. You know what I'm saying? And that was effective. you know? And it's just, why get caught? Why put your face? Why put your name? Why put your likes and your social status and your ass on the line here? You know, it's especially there's people who are the first ones to volunteer to be arrested, and sometimes they're the most vulnerable. And so what does it mean when also the privileges are mismatched? You know, it's not white people lining up, and there are white people lining up, and like, that's fine. Go ahead and do that civil disobedience thing. That's your vibe. Go ahead. You know, but that's not what catches attention. Money catches attention, you know? Anyway, so I'll just leave it at that for.
I wanted to just get a little deeper into the greenwashing and green capitalism component. And perhaps Bearcat, you might want to add to this because, you know, we're looking at these proposals like the Green New Deal that has been proposed, and even the sort of, you know, what I would consider a pseudo radical response of the Red New Deal by the Red Nation, the Marxist group that has been fairly problematic in this region. You know, but when we talk about greenwashing, I mean, we have to be clear that that means, you know, prisons being green, you know, it means, you know, composting at prisons. It means the U.S. military being one of the largest users of green technologies because they want to be autonomous or self-sufficient in the battlefield, you know. And it also looks like part of the response to the war in Ukraine, where the Defense Production Act is being invoked by the Biden administration to, you know, say, well, we need, this is one of the reasons we need to disentangle ourselves from corporate globalization and be energy independent, which is further targeting indigenous lands here. You know, I'm not trying to say that to make a distinction between like the nationalist agendas, but really look at the implications of what this larger concept of climate justice and just transition means if we're talking about it in the context of one, settler and resource colonialism, and two, global industrial capitalism. So, you know, it'd be great to hear y'all's thoughts about that.
Yeah, I could add to that. Like, I think like from the very beginning, it's, you know, it's a false hope of just rebranding, you know, where they're like, okay, you know, we want this autonomy. We're going to move towards windmills. We're going to do, you know, however much hydro, whatever, any of these, even, you know, it comes down to solar panels, like all, there is no green, you know, resource extraction, period. There is not. Even hydroelectric, and this is a huge issue here in so-called Quebec, where it's literally run by the state, and they're damming out traditional territory. They're selling hydroelectricity to the United States, and you know, the indigenous communities are being cut out of negotiations. It's undermining sovereignty, everything. You know, so it's like this is the metamorphosis into the next stage of resource colonization, where just it looks a little bit different. It has a different face. It's a rebranding is what it is. And for people to really talk about this as climate justice is missing the mark of what that term is supposed to actually reflect when we think about justice. And it's just like, it's really, we need to have a stronger like abolitionist perspective when it comes to the connection between colonization and environmental destruction, and that we will not be able to overcome this without coming to the roots of colonization and attacking it straight ahead. And unfortunately, I think with the type of visibility that has come like post Standing Rock, you have people who are like uplifting like Deb Haaland was her name, you know, and even what's the Biden's co, like she's actually from Montreal and she's like a big
Kamala Harris.
Yeah, it's just like people are getting confused about what representation actually means, that and equating it to freedom and equating it to liberation and equating it to harm reduction, even when it's actually just a new, you know, it's like a narcissistic manipulation that's just going next level. It's a continued abuse. And, you know, Kamala Harris has like this legacy within, you know, the prison system. And it's just like people thinking they're going to vote in some type of change. This is not it. No, you know, and I'm tired of seeing all of these movements and our colleagues and folks just putting so much energy, you know, wood into their fires. You know, like we have our own, and I feel this way too about the Academy. And it's like we have our own solutions. We have our own, our knowledge systems are our lodges and our longhouses and our hogans. And like we have our own work to do in terms of revitalizing our structures, and everyone is just like caught up in the rat race. And I get it, you know, people have whatever, they've got their kids and they got their situations, but at a certain point, you know, why is everything being just built within the system? And so I feel like with the greenwashing, whether it's from the nation state of the US, which is like a joke to think of the United States of ever becoming environmentally sustainable, you know, just the sheer impact alone of the United States, but then it's like sustainable for who and sustainable for what, you know? And it's like, what is this word sustainability is starting to become like encoded as settler white supremacy. And I think that we need to start critiquing that more and actually pushing for a no, it's not sustainable. And things naturally have a life cycle. Like, as we know, you know, as the seasons change, death is natural, you know, an end is natural. And, it's difficult, but these are the things that we have to, you know, grapple with.
And that's so much of what is celebrated on Earth Day, where people are like, oh yeah, we're homesteading with our sustainable practices and composting and looking at permaculture or dry farming techniques. When it's settlers doing that, they're just sustaining settler occupation and making it green, which ultimately, you know, as you said, greenwashes genocide. It greenwashes the ongoing settler colonial violence. And, you know, that's definitely one of the things that we've sort of critiqued for years, is that no matter how green you make your, you know, your lifestyles, capitalism and colonialism are completely and totally unsustainable. And, you know, part of the reason I was trying to pull you into this conversation, Bearcat, on the level, is because your community is facing that right now with lithium mining. And our communities have faced that with the legacy of uranium mining, where, you know, part of these agreements and part of these propositions from these nation states throughout the world is that, you know, nuclear power could be considered, if you listen to the scientists, as a green technology, which, you know, if you look at, of course, the from the mining to the waste, the whole nuclear production cycle, we say no, it's a completely deadly lie.
No, absolutely. And it's just like, even with this homesteading permaculture, you know, not only is it just reifying and creating that sort of greenwashing around settlerhood, but also it's ensuring settler futurity. And I think like this needs to be challenged head on. And they're using techniques. This is also too where the racism comes as part of that, where indigenous sciences are not seen as progressive. Meanwhile, Western sciences are bringing us to the point of climate catastrophe in less than 500-600 years. You know, this, who's really, you know, advanced, right? And permaculture, this is an indigenous science, this is an indigenous technology. And it's all about any literacy of the land, even bioremediation techniques, how to pull out heavy metals, how to clean the water. A lot of these are actually traditional indigenous knowledge and sciences. And so it's actually revitalizing our knowledge systems. And so they're using our ancestors' findings, applying those methods to the territory for their own settler futurity. Okay. And this is where it needs to be repositioned as, if it's not anti-colonial, then it's not doing anything. And there's such a invisibility of the reality of indigenous sovereignty. And I feel that there's just the reproduction of terra nullius mentally is just, it's so huge, you know, and this idea of the land, you know, being inanimate as an object, and that, you know, it's an empty earth uninhabited by, you know, we are flora and fauna as indigenous peoples, you know, all these types of things. And it comes anyway, it ties to something like Marxism that views the land as a means of production. And it's always about an economic system based in on a monetary system and a fiat currency and a settler state. And Marx, he came over and he studied the Haudenosaunee. And that's where these motherfuckers begin their ideas, is all off of us. This idea of socialism, we already invented it. Democracy, we already invented it. Like, we don't need Western political theory to develop an anti-colonial or anti-capitalist analysis. Our ancestors are the anti-capitalist analysis, you know? And so whether it's Diné technology or, you know, Shoshone technology, you know, political systems, it's within our nations. And we have confederacies. You go from coast to coast to coast. We have confederacies. We have nation to nation agreements. We have it. We had this situation. Like, I mean, how do we have, we're connected by the corn, north to south. So I'm tired of it.
There's no need to reinvent the wheel here. That's a big thing. I think people tend to overthink it and think that there is no, that they're looking in a direction that there is no, that there's no reason for to be struggling, you know, with the fight up at Thacker Pass. And that's my ancestral territorial homeland. And I see a lot of the people when they're, you know, online and stuff, and they're just hearing about little tidbits and stuff being put out by these certain orgs and things. And their first thing is, oh my God, you know, contact Deb Holland. You know, you need to let Deb Holland know. And little do they know that. I mean, if they had taken the time, and if even the people in these organizations had taken the time to, you know, look at the current lawsuits and things that are going on, they will see that Deb Holland is on the other side of those lawsuits. Like, she's literally has the power to put a stop to all of that as the head of the Department of the Interior. And she is not. Not only is she not putting a stop to it, she is sicking her team of high-paid, you know, badass elite lawyers and all that after our people, our grassroots people, our people, our elders, our people that don't have the means to at all, you know, go into a legal battle with, you know, with Deb Holland. And so I think it's kind of, it's not funny, but at the same time, it's like, sometimes you just gotta, you know, you almost just want to laugh because it's like, fuck, what are we really doing? And like you were saying, and it goes into that whole ploy of representation. Like, y'all are not being represented. You are being marketed to, and you are being marketed to in front of a whole audience of people. So for a purpose, and it's becoming very, and we saw this with like the January 6th, the riots or whatever they would like to call it in DC. And we saw so many of the orgs and the org-minded people completely throwing a fit, like, oh, this is terrible. And meanwhile, we're over here like, okay, do your thing. And, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah, like catching the popcorn.
Yeah, right? And but that's when I really started taking note of the way that it seems that our viewpoints almost align if you were to look at it from the outside. But in the inside, when you're in like the veins of it, they're completely opposites, but they're so opposite, they're almost back around, you know? And it can be very confusing. And this is a point that they are playing on. This is a point that they are actively seeking out and co-opting. And these are the things that we need to not only educate ourselves on, but be aware of and be on the lookout for the tactics. And I think it's really interesting. I would like to hear more what you think about the tactics that are going on. And if there's anything that, you know, you could or would like to share with our audience members on how to do that actively, because as people on the front lines, you don't always, you're not always able to share some of the things. And so from people that aren't on the front lines, but do things that make our lives difficult. There's a huge disconnect there. And at some point we're going to have to start, you know, finding ways to connect those things. So, but yeah, I completely hear everything you're saying, and it's just like, it's frustrating. I hear the frustration and I agree with it. I see it. It's valid.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Bearcat. Like, I think, I saw you post that about Deb Haaland when she got in, when she got elected or whatever. I'm on Instagram as Scrimp Scrap. I don't know if you're...
Oh, okay.
I don't use it too much, but I interact with your account a couple times, and I was like, this is exactly... I was so not shocked to hear that. And it's like, it's really about that assimilation piece, and I think that all too often, we just get caught up in these politics of whatever recognition and visibility, representation. And like, obviously, yes, it is powerful to see, you know, yourself represented in a world where you're constantly erased. Like, we're dealing with the death culture of colonial capitalism on the daily, you know, but also, you know, where, you know, I want to see myself being represented, like, within spaces of my choosing and like within cultural spaces and within, you know, fellow like indigenous spaces. And I want to see, you know, non-indigenous people actually talking about invisibilizing the settler colonial project instead of leaving it all on us all the time. And that's the type of visibilization I want to see. I want to see like the abuse actually be talked about and no longer kept like in hiding in secret. And I think that there's just so much work to be done. In terms of tactics, like, do you mean in terms of how, like what those guys were doing, like with that January 6th stuff, or like more in terms of like a frontline style?
Honestly, I see it a lot more of our own people doing the work for them. And it's like, what the hell? You guys want to talk shit about us about, oh, you guys are divisive. You're doing the state's job for them, this and that. And it's like, you're literally doing their job for them. And it's things like that, like in connection into that, I guess.
Like policing each other and all this kind of stuff. I think part of it, when I've seen it really strong, it's like, I think it's really difficult because, you know, we have all this intergenerational trauma that we're navigating, and it's really difficult when you come up into conflict with folks and maybe you have different ideas about how to approach something. And especially with this conversation around violence or nonviolence, or even what is violence, you know, like it's a big, tired conversation, I think. And, you know, it's very difficult, especially when you're dealing in intergenerationally, where you might have different perspectives. There's always, obviously, too, like, but, you know, from the Haudenosaunee perspective, it's like with the warrior societies, you know, their job is to carry the burden of peace. You know, you're not just fighting for no reason, you know, and you're not fighting to kill or wipe each other out. It's to protect yourself. It's a form of self-defense. And just like, you know, tying to rape culture as well, like, If you have to defend yourself, you have to defend yourself, and that needs to be respected. And really understanding like our goals, I think, is really helpful to try to be like, okay, well, if our goal is to say stop a project, then what's the most effective way to do that that's the safest for everyone? And I think there's a lot of internalized, just, you know, there's a lot of just, we've been so historically policed as Indigenous peoples, that there's just such a sense sometimes of like, oh, we have to do it a certain way. Like, we need to do a petition and we need to go knock on Deb Haaland's door and like ask, you know, President Biden, please, please help us. Like, obviously not, you know, and this is just why something like the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls in Canada, you know, there was a positive thing that came out of it. And my friend Autumn Godwin was talking about this. You know, that survivors got to actually speak to their experiences, right? But also, and just like with any royal commission, whether it's deaths in custody in Australia, Indigenous people there being killed by the state, doing a royal commission, it's so that way the perpetrator can investigate themselves and then they can put it on a shelf and they can say, we did something, you know? So we need to really think about what is the system change that we're looking for. And part of that is, I think, also having some patience when people don't have the same perspective and trying, how do we educate each other and how in a gentle way, but not too gentle either. You know what I mean? Sometimes we need to get a little rough and kind of push back, but then also to sort of like, maybe even also showing by example too can also be another thing, because there is a lot of misinformation and stuff like that happening with the internet and the way that social media and everything, and like people are like the Russians, whatever. I don't know. You know, like at the end of the day, it could all be state generated AI bots. Like, we don't know. you know? And like, so what is a priority for in-person relationships? Who are people accountable to? How do we hold each other accountable? And, you know, also like, where are we putting in that work? And so for me, I'm really inspired by some of my colleagues at the Buckskin Babes and, you know, who are doing language revitalization. They're focusing on traditional farming, seed saving, you know, animal hide processing, and just like really too, like if when you gear it into that land-based relationship, everybody comes, like the community comes to that. People are very hungry for that connection to the land. And I think that's why even some people find themselves on front lines, because, you know, it's kind of like going out on the bush, and it's, you have a sense of purpose and you have this kind of togetherness. And I think creating those environments for us to share and learn together, that maybe aren't always based in a reactionary perspective, not to say that we have to react, we have to respond, we have to resist, but also to plan and to prepare for what we want to see. So I don't know if I'm really answering your question, but there you go. No,
it's very interesting. And the ties between the ways that we are reflected in the land and the land relates to us as well. There's a very strong connection there. So of course, like when things start getting, you know, so chaotic, especially like, it seems like the last thing you would want to do is go out on the front lines and get shot at or, you know, arrested or this or that. But it seems like a lot of our people are feeling pulled to those spaces. And I feel like there's a relationality there and that's very real with us. And, but yeah, there's a very strong tie there. It's funny that you, well, not funny, but like, it's interesting that you mention, a lot of the work being done around, like sexual violence and, I guess authoritarian violence and, how that relates also to state violence, because, one of the tactics, I guess I would see, and it is a touchy subject. So, but acknowledging that, we'll go ahead and go into it, 'cause that's what we do. This whole idea that I've seen that the people that are, you know, ACAB and fuck the police, all this kind of shit, like are the first ones that will disbelieve a victim, you know, that when they come forward with the truth, with their truth and say, hey, this is what's going on and I need help. They're the first ones that'll turn around and be like, well, where's your proof? And it's like, that is a state-based authoritarian tactic. How is that going to work for us? How has that ever worked for us? And these are some of the things that I see in relationality with land-based trauma. And these are things that we have control over to stop doing. And I feel like there is a lot of work that's being done around that. But I feel like there's so many people still on the fence about it. And, you know, oh, it's a he said, she said. Oh, there's two sides to every story. Like, nah, there's really not. there's not. And when you said like we need to take a gentle approach, but also sometimes not a gentle, I feel what you're saying with that, because sometimes it's just like, no, sometimes we're being expected as femmes or as, you know, women that we have to take a certain, we have to have a certain gentleness, a certain grace about it. But at the same time, like back in the day, that was not the case. Like that was not the case at all. That was not our role. And that was not an expectation. That is a settler requirement or set, you know, something set by the state, and it's not there to serve us either. So these things are important to talk about.
I just wanted to just real quick jump in and say that I don't think gender-based violence, interpersonal violence apologism is unique to radical leftists, though. I think it happens across the board. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the way that people sure. get a pass for, you know, sticking a badge on for radical politics is sort of, you know, I think what needs to be contended, or a big part of what needs to be contended with as well. Absolutely. And I wanted to like get a little bit more into and connect these points about something that you've written about. And I think you're noted for especially formulating and articulating early on what has become more widely known and adopted in land-based, you know, critiques and around land back is this idea of land back, or I mean, land trauma. And maybe you could break down a little bit about what you mean by that. I know you've written quite a bit and talked about that. But how is that understanding connected to missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, two-spirit and trans struggles, and maybe sort of bringing that together? Because I think this important, this topic about sexual violence and gender-based violence is really a key component of this as well, especially when we're talking about Deb Haaland, who on one hand is, you know, leading the charge for, you know, on one level, there's this sort of strategy of picking low-hanging fruit and protecting areas that aren't as critically involved in the overall infrastructure of the U.S. Energy production. And then two, you know, pushing for more policing as a response to missing and murdered Indigenous women, as, you know, a lot of Indigenous folks are celebrating the actions of the Biden administration to address this issue here in the U.S. context. So, you know, on one hand, they're like, you know, opening up more oil and gas lease sales than the first, you know, few months of the Trump administration's or first year of Trump administration. I can't remember the exact, you know, statistic. I think Biden signed more oil and gas leases in his first year than Trump did, for whatever that matters. But yeah, so the question again is, can you talk about land trauma and how this understanding is connected to missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, two-spirit and trans?
Yeah, for sure, Klee. Yeah, I'm going to try to address all these things. Too, when what you were talking about, Bearcat, about that connection with the land and being reflected in the land as well, like that made me think of something that Frida Hewson has said from the Wet'suwet'en Nation over at Unist'ot'en. And, you know, she would always say too, like, you know, of course there's calls for supporters to show up there and go through the protocol if they're given access. But she would also say, like, you know, your ancestors are waiting for you in your homelands, and what you do to protect your territory helps us protect our territory, you know. And that also connects to, I had the opportunity to go to so-called Australia in like 2015 or 16, I think it was, or 17, I don't know, years anymore, they all just bleed together. And you know, some of the you know, Indigenous folks there, they were talking about how our sacred fires are connected across the world, you know. So when yous are having a sacred fire, like, it's connected to the other sacred fires that are happening at that same time. And so I think it's really important to put that time and energy into our own home fires. And what does that look like, and what does that mean, and what are our ancestral territories, and what are our responsibilities to our traditional territories, and to, you know, like, obviously, yes, there's an interconnection, but also you can be just as effective sometimes staying home. So I just wanted to throw that out there. And on the point of, like, I definitely feel you, Klee, what you're saying, leftist spaces are not the only ones, but it's definitely a problem, a hypocritical type of problem. And almost maybe because there's such a heightened politicization within some of these spaces that it becomes like this political thing. They're like, oh, he said, she said, and people want to debate it, or whatever kind of reaction they're having. Whereas in some of these maybe even normie spots, like, they might even handle it sometimes better. I don't know. But irregardless, I think what it comes down to is politics being like a shorthand for values, when really it's an aesthetic. What's come to be now where we are is largely aesthetic, and it's fashionable, and it's, you know, it's a Pokemon set, basically. And it's that's the vibe that I'm noticing more and more and more. And even with, and I think it's really connected to the rise of social media and the development and the normalcy of social media, and that idea of, like, you know, rolling up to the blockade just to get your selfie, and, you know, all these types of things. And, like, even just the roles that white saviors insert themselves into our communities through anti-capitalist movements, through anarchist movements, and, you know, to be in support of climate justice, allegedly. And then they're coming in and doing all kinds of predatory stuff. And I think, and it's also too, it's not just outsiders, it's also our own community. And that's when it becomes the hardest. And it's something that we're constantly dealing with. And like, really, at the end of the day, you know, and we had to do this at the Hyde camp. We were notified that there was an abuser, and I asked them to leave. And it's like, but also like, it's always a small few who are going to ask them to leave, you know? And like, sometimes it could, maybe there's dynamics where some people aren't safe to do it. Like it will be unsafe, you know? And so just how do we also normalize identifying predatory behavior? And sharing that information with one another, and also how to de-escalate a situation and exit, either bounce by force or like in a way that is as safe as possible for the survivors in the space. And so how to do that, and just sort of building those skills, you know, that should be right along with any other frontline skill, is how to handle these types of situations. And also it's gets complicated because sometimes people have relationships, and there might be people who are being outed as abusers who are close with the hosts, and you're on their territory. Then what, you know? And I think this is the really difficult thing that, you know, I was, you know, and I've been, and it's hard to see people who you thought would do better and hold a safer space, like fail to do that, you know, at times. But like, I think it's also like very difficult to assign, you know, individual responsibility when we have a collective responsibility. And so how do we actually enact that collective responsibility and hold each other and hold a space accountable? I think it's a lot of work that requires having a trauma-informed approach, and actually what does survivor-centrism look like, and how do we also educate people on consent? You know, and how do we normalize and discuss and visibilize processes of consent? And that's what I really like with a lot of land-based practices, is it's very much based in consent protocols with the territory, and with the people around you. And like, things can get, you know, really, like, things can get hairy really quickly. You know, if you get sustain an injury in the bush, or, you know, if you can also, you're like, just things can go wrong. You know, you're at the whim of the natural world, right? So having that closeness and the ability to communicate with one another and all those types of things. So I think it's like, how do we combat that idealization of what do our decolonial spaces look like? But then also, like, how do we identify predatory behavior and even, you know, recognize when it's happening around us. And I think it's really tricky, and there's no like ABC set to get it done. Anyway, so that was for the first half of that. And then on to like, so discussing land trauma, I would say like, I guess I coined this phrase, but it's also like, I would consider it a community term that came out of discussion and dialogue with, you know, peers, relatives, friends, and talking about, especially within the, you know, as Indigenous people who are focusing on land-based work, you know, especially trying to prevent extractive industry on our territory, and just dealing with the repercussions of that, and even like in conversation with, you know, Indigenous peoples from north to south, east to west, right? And like, was talking about land trauma for the longest time, I didn't really have a definition. It was just something that other Indigenous people automatically we would feel. You would be like, oh yeah, I know what you mean by that. And like the ways that our territories are being destroyed and how that makes us feel, and this mental health impact. And like, not only that, but then the cultural and nationhood and sovereignty based impacts of our sacred sites being under attack, you know, and what happens when even maybe certain ceremonies or protocols maybe are being under threat because of threats onto the territory, onto those sacred sites. So that's really what, you know, land trauma is about that embodied, those embodied feelings as Indigenous peoples, I've seen like some rebranding or whatever from the settler side talking about climate anxiety, which I thought was kind of funny. It was like, all right, maybe that's more accessible for people. Non-natives are like getting their climate anxiety. But for us, you know, we have that land body connection. And I think when it comes to like, you know, missing and murdered, Erin Marie Cosmo, who's a Two-Spirit Métis artist with Native Youth Sexual Health Network formerly. And, you know, they would always talk, they have this piece of art and it's like titled, My Body is Not Terra Nullius. And, you know, even in the Environmental Violence Toolkit, Vanessa Gray from Omgenong talks about that when our view of the land becomes so low, then the view of our women also becomes low. And it's that land body connection. And it's also that gender, you know, connection too, where the land is something that nurtures us and that gives us life. You know, we literally talk about the land as Mother Earth. This is our origin place. You know, they provide for us everything that we need. And in a lot of ways, that's kind of modeling those nurturing relationships of like, you know, from our families, right? And so what it should be anyway. And so it's like that idea, you know, of terra nullius, whether it's on the land or that idea of terra nullius is being projected onto our bodies, you know, it's a means of degradation. And so I also think that, you know, when it comes to like intimate partner violence and gender-based violence, you know, as Indigenous peoples, like who are experiencing land trauma, like that also means that we're going to have a struggle with our mental health. We're going to have like, it's like, I think it's very difficult to have models for healthy relationships sometimes within our own communities. And it's very difficult to deal with that when people are like reenacting cycles of trauma and cycles of abuse and perpetuating that on one another. And I think it's really difficult to be able to just, you know, just break free from that and just like, okay, yeah, you know, I'm gonna just enter this relationship with this person. And like, whether they're queer or not, you know, intimate partner violence happens in queer community as well. And it's something that is, I think, it's a lot bigger than just like our own individual experiences, but it's also part of a culture, you know? Mm-hmm. And this is where I think like, you know, really looking at the links between rape culture and terra nullius can help us to understand how these systems are playing out in our relationships and on our bodies. And I think also that, you know, with this idea of, you know, land trauma also comes the recognition that our territories are being exploited. And, you know, people have talked about this for so long, and that relationship of exploitation being based into the territory also means that exploitation is going to be the point of relating to one another. And so that's going to increase, you know, rates of gender-based violence. And when it comes to policing agencies, and I was just like shocked when I heard you saying that like Indian country in the States is like celebrating more cops, you know, it's like to deal with like missing and murdered. It's like, first of all, the cops are directly implicated. Half of them are involved in these, and like also there's like human trafficking that's happening at the same time, you know, which is like separate from the sex worker industry, you know. So it's like there's all these like layers, and at the end of the day, if people are vulnerable from our own communities and they don't feel safe to like speak up and talk about it, then we're doing something wrong. So whether you agree with sex work or not, it doesn't really fucking matter, because sex workers need to feel safe in our own communities. And also like people who are, you know, but that doesn't mean we can't also talk about the impacts of human trafficking. And when we all know like man camps, like I feel like, you know, this is stuff that we all know, you know, as there's increased activity for extraction on the territory, there's also increased, you know, gender-based violence faced by Indigenous women and trans folks and queer folks and Two-Spirit folks, and also youth and children and minors, you know. And I think that just actually naming these systems of violence and trying to visibilize them and actually understand what is consent and normalizing consent, like, are really key starting points. But yeah, I don't know. So I feel like I hope that kind of got some of those pieces going there.
Yeah, I think you made a really interesting point, but I think it might help if people understood that the first relationship with the state is abusive as fuck. I mean, we're not asked if we want to be a part of it. We're not asked if we want to join. No, they just assign us a number and we're like, oh, hey, what's up? I'm here for the party. Like, and so that, and it's definitely reflected in every single part. And so it does feel weird to go opposite that, you know, when it's become so normalized. But yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was just going to add that, like, I mean, we're caught between, at least in the US context, between the Defense Production Act and the Violence Against Women Act. And they can't see, at least from an institutional perspective, the colonial social order can't see how they're contradictory to each other and ultimately will produce, you know, and replicate that ongoing violence against our bodies.
Well, we've actually already seen them tactically using the MMIW Act with the federal officers that are allowed to go into our territories now with that act against land defenders and, you know, the Winnemucca Indian Colony. We believe that that's one of the ways that they have been able to come onto, you know, the land that they don't have jurisdiction over, is that because they're actively investigating under that task force ability, I guess, exploiting that. And that's something I saw immediately, like, oh, you're going to bring extra cops in and give them extra powers? Like, how is this going to, how? I don't know. I don't know how anyone could have even thought that that was a good idea, but yeah, right. No one really asked me, so.
You know,
I wanted to add.
No, one quick thing. That's really interesting too, because I think we don't talk about the history of the police too often, and actually their historical role and what really, how they came about in the United States and in Canada. In Canada, it was like the Queens, like they were called the Northwestern Mounted Police, and their job was literally to subjugate and subdue Indigenous peoples in order to protect the Pilgrims as they made their way west, and to help to clear the land. And then later, when Canada was formed, to enforce residential schools and the pass system, all kinds of things like that through the Indian Act. And the United States is white vigilante colonists, okay, in the 13 colonies, who actually started their own patrols, slave patrols, rangers, and scalp hunters. And that was the proto police, okay? And so the origin story for the police is white vigilantes who are slave owners and, you know, settler colonists who are looking to police their newly acquired, you know, stolen lands, and they're targeting literally, you know, and that's where the practice of scalping put a bounty on our heads. And it provided a financial incentive to create this culture of, you know, violence against Indigenous peoples, but also Black folks as well were being targeted. So if you were a Black person or a Native person at this time, and you were seen somewhere you were not supposed to be, you could just be jumped by basically, you know, these rangers. And that's the origins, you know, and it's even that like phrase of like paddy wagon. We talk about that, you know, the paddy wagon, people get, you know, thrown into the paddy wagon. It comes from, the etymology comes from slave patrols, because it went slave patrols, and then it was like patrollers and patroller rollers, and then it became eventually paddy rollers, and then that's where the term phrase paddy wagon came from. So between the antebellum South and the 13 colonies, you know, like those developments, it was rangers and literally scalp hunters. So that was the proto police. And like, so no wonder when we think about those colonial origins as white vigilante violence, settler nationalist violence, it's just like, it makes sense where they are today. And so again, and it, of course, you know, the United States is never going to bring into an act, a bill. They're not going to pass legislation that's ever going to systemically bring justice to Indigenous peoples or Indigenous women, you know. And also a quick note to what I said before of like, you know, it doesn't matter if you agree with sex work or not, but also like, I think that it's also none of people's business, and that there's no ethical work under capitalism, and that if people have the agency and they're in a, you know, like that's their damn choice, you know, and we shouldn't be stigmatizing people. And I'm really sad to see how much stigma is being passed around, you know, too. And I might be in a minority on this, but even with the Red Road too, like I think like sobriety is extremely important. But at the end of the day, you know, if people are surviving and they're still with us, then that's what matters the most. And even for sober folks who fall off the wagon, like the amount of stigma they face, you know, to then have to, you know, and also like, just also too, like certain lifestyles, it's a coping mechanism at times. And like, yes, like ceremony can offer that, but you might not always be in those spaces and the type of trauma people are dealing with. So anyway, all around saying like stigma is fucking deadly, but not in a good way, you know? And yeah, I would like to see that attitude shift as well, you know, especially in our more like radical indigenous spaces to, you know, allow people, as long as they're not harming one another, is like, you know, if your sobriety or lack of sobriety isn't hurting me, that's like a different story, you know? Like it's, you have every right to say if someone's harming you, you know, to create your own boundaries around that and to limit that exposure. But just on the day to day, you know, that stigma, I'm not here for it. So yeah.
Absolutely. And we suffer from those attacks on who we are through dehumanization, which, you know, of course, when people are dehumanized, their exploitation is expected. And I think like you sort of identifying how policing works, because I mean, you know, if we look at Standing Rock, as you keep referencing, or any other front lines of the struggles in resistance to ongoing resource colonialism, the police are the front line to defend capital, to defend the colonial system. So, you know, I mean, even the movement to defund the police, it's like, what are we talking about, an economic struggle? Or are we talking about something deeper? So, you know, I wanted to shift the conversation as we try to wrap things up towards, you know, the inevitable question of like, where do we go from here? And I think we've asked that a little bit, but, you know, we're stuck between this Green New Deal, which basically is reinforcing exactly what you're addressing. Part of its cores is that there will always be a legislated enforceable component that is tied to the violence of the state, which is usually represented through the police and driven by capitalist interest. So it's deeply embedded in the colonial project, settler colonial and resource colonial projects. And then, you know, on the flip side of that, as part of a response has been, you know, the Red New Deal from the Red Nation, which a lot of leftists are embracing because it uses a lot of great buzzwords, but it's a largely plagiarized document. It's not original, and even the Red Nation acknowledges that in their text. But the ultimate proposal is that this Marxist organization's proposition is for a decolonized authoritarian worker-run state as their solution. And then on another side of this, we also have eco-fascists, you know, who are blaming migrants, you know, or overpopulation, and looking at a range of other, you know, responses. And ecofascism isn't just a unique expression from the right. It's also, you know, embedded in mm-hmm. like anarchist or left, you know, radical leftist spaces as well. So you brought up the issue of like climate anxiety. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, and we've written a bit of this, or about this with Indigenous Action. But, you know, even the sort of talking point that people are using a lot is that Indigenous people protect 80% of the world's biosphere. And we have this new report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change from the UN, who are sounding, you know, even much more as this sort of doomer alarm of the stakes being extremely high and the time frame being extremely limited. But then when we see, like, you know, the responses, the reactions, these are some of the places that we're stuck between. So the question again is, where do we go from here? What strategies and tactics should we be focusing on from your perspective? You've brought up you know, sovereignty, and you brought up some of these other things. I'm curious as to what your response is.
Yeah, wow. That's a lot. I think like also this Red Nation needs to pick up a dictionary and look up the word decolonized. Because come on. Oh, it's that bad. You know, I mean, it just goes to show how bad things are. I think it's worse than it's ever been, I feel, you know, to be honest, in terms of just critical thinking and even shared understandings around things, at least in my, from my lived experience in my lifetime, where things are at. And yeah, I hear it all the time, these kind of eco-fascist perspectives within leftist spaces of like, overpopulation is the problem. It's like, no, that is not the problem. How many human beings are on this earth is not the problem, you know? And it's like, it comes down again to these systems of exploitation. And it's like, what we need is to actually dare to dream of something different instead of just reforming the same cycle of abuse again and again and again and again over the land as a resource. Like, you know, just coming, we need to back it up, doctrine of discovery, terra nullius, and we need to unwind this thinking and no longer look at the land as empty, as the peoples of the lands as non-existent, as subhuman. You know, this is the stuff that needs to be done. And I think like also it really comes into that nation building piece as well. So it's that interpersonal and individual, you know, healing journey of dealing with our own traumas and whatever we can within our families and healing our lines for the next generations. But also how do we bring that back to our clans and into our nations and really rebuilding our structures, you know, our longhouses, our lodges, and how are we coming back to our original instructions? And I think that needs to be the focus for us as Indigenous peoples, is all of that. And like, honestly too, like learn your languages as much as you can and speak to your elders, you know, as much as we can, because we're in a time where we're going to need this information and we're going to have to pass it on to the next generations. And at the end of the day, protecting our territory is the most important thing that we can be doing. And it's going to be, and like, you know, recycling programs, like half of these places go and burn recycling. Like, this is not the solution. And I think for folks on the outside, for non-natives, it's like, smarten the fuck up, like get it together. This is sad. This is really sad. Like for how long as Indigenous peoples, you know, and it's not about whether or not the earth will survive. That's not the conversation. You know, it's going to be whether the ecosystems that as we know of them today will survive, you know, including us, right? And so it's not like the earth is not going to find a way to regenerate life one day, or that there will be some, you know, some survivors who are able to withstand, you know, but it's all this, it's the suffering in the meantime and who's being most like proportionally impacted by that. And so I think like, you know, no more flashy campaigns, no more money to the state, no more money to NGOs, like grassroots, sacred fire, you know, team up, affinity group only, don't publicize what you're doing, no more talk, only action, you know, like call on the Beaver Nation if you must. You know what I'm saying? Like, and LC did it, and they did it. They were successful. They pushed SWIN out. And that's something to say, you know, because at the end of the day, they have so much, you know, and there's a lot of, you know, counterintelligence, you know, Gord Hill, he publishes so much stuff around counterintelligence tactics and ways to prevent, you know, drone surveillance and all of these types of things. So we need to be taking it a little more seriously, and not so like set the egos to the side. You know, it's not about who you're snagging on the front lines. Okay. It's not about any of that shit. We need to seriously get it together. And also too, I think like this is also not to say like, you know, there's this one, I heard this one person say before, like his name, he's from the Mohawk Nation. He's like he's very knowledgeable, older generation, like I guess you could say an elder too, you know, but he's very, very super knowledgeable. And he was like, you know, prayers, if you're hungry, do you pray? No, like you go out and you feed your family. You know what I mean? And I think like that, I really value that perspective. And I think like, but at the same time, we do need to also engage our ceremonies. And like, maybe this is something where we need to ask, I don't know, the Star Lodges for help, or, you know, that maybe there are, you know, our, whatever you want to call it, like our, you know, our indigenous like power, you know, that's like beyond these like sort of settler views of like time and all this stuff, you know, like we can tap into, and get some assistance, you know. But at the same time, and at the same time, it's like, and for me, it's not or, it's and we need to all of these things at the same time, you know. So work on our trauma, fucking identify predatory behavior, uplift our sovereignty, our nation building, learn our territories, do what we can to be within the cycle of the natural world, you know, and stop putting shit on social media, do it in the real life. And seriously, like it's going to be like, it's to the point now too, with like everybody and like, whatever. I watch TikTok. I don't know if that's whatever. I watch TikTok. You know what I'm saying? Like I'm not using the internet, but at the same time, like it's at the point where, you know, the police in China, they have facial recognition technology in their fucking glasses and they scan a crowd just looking for warrants. Like this is not like the Snapchat filters. They're not just for you to look cute and to look like a puppy dog. They're literally, this is big technology. They are collecting so much data and they are practicing the, you know, they're fine tuning these technologies on the general population, and you're uploading your face and it's facial recognition technology, that software, it's interlinked, you know. And just like with the G20 summits, like whenever they put in a bunch of new infrastructure within the city to monitor what's happening, they don't take it out at the end. It's still there. So you're walking around and your face, you're being monitored. You know, we are being monitored, whether it's actively by whatever piglets are being paid to listen to our podcast right now. Hello, FBI. Hello, RCMP. Hello, CSIS. How are you guys doing? Pay some bills. But anyway, you know, but or it's indirectly. And soon it's going to be done by artificial intelligence. It's going to be algorithms. And it's already happening on Instagram. People talk about being shadow banned. You know, so all this type of stuff, like we need to seriously come correct with some critical thinking, and that this is, it's not safe. We really are not safe. And we need to also like adapt as such. I think that with the way that advocacy and even post, I don't know more, it was like, you know, we need to be visible and we need to share our voices, which is true. But there's also, you know, I think it's come almost to celebrity at this point. And where are the priorities, you know, because at the end of the day, and like, whatever, I'm already on shout outs, call outs, but like Honor the Earth, like they're not supporting people in the long term, you know, just like Indigenous Environmental Network, like how many people, you know, had to deal with all of this state violence, and where was the aftercare? Where was the system? Where was the support? Where was people getting money to be able to show up to court, or even just to pay their bills, or to get therapy, or to get physiotherapy? You know, all the types of things that are being pushed onto our marginalized community members for certain people to build a platform. And it's not a popular opinion, and it's not, and it's like, anyway, I'm just going off.
Yeah, go off. That's what this section's for. Sometimes we just need to. It needs to be said.
Yeah, and I mean the whole idea of this show is just to go deeper. And you know, part of our tagline, one is we're autonomous, anti-colonial, anti-capitalist, and we, you know, celebrate the bridges that burn, that light our way, or the wagons that burn, that we burn, have to burn to light our way. And I think this is, these are important, critical conversations, because these are desperate times. And, you know, the more that the state represses us, because the state violence is real, and these nonprofit or NGOs that are just feeding people into that so they can, you know, take some pictures and satisfy their funders and increase their revenue streams. I mean, like Indian Collective has like, you know, tens of millions of dollars now. And this sort of like And we wrote about this, and I don't know if we're going to read this little part at the end, Bearcat, but I guess we can here. We can add it in later or link to it. But we talk about it being the colonizer's burden with this idea of, you know, the indigenous people protect 80% of the world's biosphere, because, you know, the twisted logic of settler colonialism and climate activism is to reduce our ways and beings to, you know, and complex ongoing struggles to campaign talking points mm-hmm. that only prove that we deserve a seat at the table. And what we wrote is that it's changed through arithmetic by way of better self-marketing, branding, and advertising, when through ceremony and a myriad of tactically dynamic direct actions, we protect all of existence, not just percentages. And this is part of the problem with these talking points. You know, our power isn't found at the colonizer's table. It's found and rekindled in its well-fed flames. Another thing that we wrote about was, you know, the forefront, and I think you touched on this quite a bit, is the forefront of indigenous climate justice groups that proselytize the narrative of their own victimhood in terms of that increased funding streams to their nonprofit corporations to pay their bloated salaries in climate action protest protestcations, I guess, aka PR stunts with the legal team and retainer, you know, all while mm-hmm. they compete for the spotlight and rally with celebrities to build organizational recognition and homogeneity of popular purpose, not to mention a standardization of the role or the rote tactical and strategic stagnation, which, you know, mm-hmm. we're talking about marching in circles. We had these same conversations and critiques, you know, during the climate justice marches that they had in New York City, where they had Leonardo DiCaprio, right? Like, you know, leading the march and indigenous people, you know, vying for that space at the front. It's just this indigenous struggle. This is our land. And now indigenous, you know, some of these nonprofit indigenous groups are celebrating that the IPCC report, recent report, acknowledges colonialism and references colonialism. But it also, I mean, there are whole sections on tourism. You know, it talks about tourism more than colonialism. You know, there's nothing that it's committed to addressing on a systemic level when it's ultimately reinforcing itself and its machinations that are established on the destruction of Mother Earth and its people. But yeah, I don't know if you want to just wrap up any thoughts, any things that we missed. You already were getting into the shout outs and call outs, so I don't know how much we need to do that. Or actually, you haven't hit the shout outs yet. So if there's any,
just call us.
You know, shout outs you want to give for your work, things that you're working on, even if they're unrelated to this, because, you know, that's part of the issue I have too, is just like the logic of nonprofit climate justice activism is that it puts people in these compartments. It's like, oh, this is their mm-hmm. issue. This is what they're working on. This is what this organization is working on. It's just like, no, we all have shared responsibility because we are living in this planet that is being burned by capitalists mm-hmm. and colonizers.
Yeah. Wow. So many like wrapping up thoughts, but I don't know. I just want to add to, like, you know, the internet, that was a military this was developed through the military, and its applications are military. Okay. And even when we look at, you know, there was on TikTok recently, they were like, oh, what to do when like a robot dog polices the US-Mexico border, you know, like this is, it's not a joke, like, and it's coming so fast. And we think that regular cops suck. Like, imagine when they're robots, you know, like the coming RoboCop apocalypse is not going to be fun. And it's like, yeah, it's coming quickly. So I really just like, we need to get that together a little bit. I just wanted to add that because this is something I've just been really on. And just the view of like Western technology as superior when it clearly isn't. And even looking at settler colonialism as a set of technologies and the way that green capitalism is like fits right into that, because it's assimilating descent and all of that And all of that, you know, all of that, you know, momentum that could be poured into, because, you know, there's obviously, you know, young people coming up, 20, 19, 18 years old, like they know how bad of a situation they are. And people do have a sense of anxiety and panic, and they want to do something and they want to do direct action, but they just don't have anywhere to connect to. And the spaces that do have access to them are bringing them back inside of the machine, you know? So it's a lot of work cut out for us. And also too, just on land trauma, like I think it's really important to recognize that this is something that we're all dealing with as Indigenous peoples. And it's also so culturally specific, you know, depending on your sacred sites and also your lived experiences and where you've grown up. So I just like, I'm definitely always interested to hear, you know, what other people have to say about this or how it's impacted them. Cause it can sometimes be hard always speaking into the negative of like articulating the violence. And it's really interesting to sort of see, and that's where I'm kind of starting to think now is like, where does that sort of land healing come? And, you know, like, and I see it especially in, you know, some of my peers who are doing a lot of like food sovereignty work around seed saving, planting, harvesting, and there's a lot there that's super generative. Yeah. And even too, like learning, you know, and practicing remediation techniques and pulling out these like heavy metals from our territories. Like, how are we going to, once we reach our futurity, you know, our anti-colonial, decolonial, you know, sovereign future, you know, how are we going to heal the land, you know, that we, you know, that where's the reciprocity back to the territory? So yeah, I guess for shout outs, I guess, yeah, Buckskin Babes, Urban Moosehide Tanning Collective. We don't have any social media yet. One day we will, I guess. We'll just send it to you guys. You can reshare us. I have been working on what I like to call a life-affirming art practice. I have an Instagram handle. It's called Scrimp Scrap with SKs. Yeah, I don't know. I've been just trying to lay low and make it through. But it's really nice to speak with folks and just to feel connected, and just to address all of these things. Like there's a lot of baggage, I think, that we're all dealing with within the climate justice movement and even within, you know, our own sovereignty movements and all those sort of like internal politics of abusers and sellouts and, you know, the impacts of NGOization, because it definitely does, you know, it kicks a girl when she's down to see, you know, to see everybody just kind of, it's really hard to, you know, try to divest from a system that everyone's participating in, you know? So it's really important to build those networks of mutual aid and to reach out to each other. So I just want to say, you know, Niawa to Bearcat and Klee for inviting me out. And, you know, fuck Earth Day, man. Every day is Earth Day. You know, I don't know. People used to just turn their lights off for an hour. It's not going to do nothing. Like, we need a little something more than that.
There's a nice assertion that some of the folks that I know put out there every Earth Day. They're like, Earth Night is greater than Earth Day.
Nice. Along those lines, I'd like to say, if anything, let's co-opt that shit, make it Beaver Day. Beaver Night.
Yes. Beaver Day.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for coming on, and I was very excited to get a chance to talk to you, and you know, you're just very inspiring, your work, and thank you for all the effort and the work that you put in. It does not go unnoticed, even though sometimes it feels like it, even though sometimes everything you say makes everyone mad. I like it.
Yeah. Yo. And I appreciate, like, you know, and I just want to emphasize this, because I think there's a lot of young people, especially, and I think that's, you know, you're talking about folks who are, they want to do shit. They have that panic, that anxiety, and they want to rush to the front lines. And who is it managed by? These nonprofit capitalists who are, you know, securing their streams to funders, or, you know, groups, you know, Marxist groups who are trying to be the vanguard and, you know, pull people into their agendas, their platforms. When, you know, we even with IEN, as you mentioned, like, you know, this is, I guess, a bit of my call out thing too, is like they've issued a report last year where I think they said that indigenous resistance to 20 fossil fuel projects has stopped or delayed carbon emissions equivalent to approximately 25% of US and Canada's overall emissions. So they were like, you know, these climate activists were revealing the power of direct action, but the critique is that they've also assigned their campaigns more credit than is due, particularly because they cited losses like Dakota Access Pipeline and Line 3 projects in their reports. But it, you know, to me, it's the concern is that it tends towards a diluted climate optimism, where if we're not being honest with and about the failings of our movements, what is shifting tactics and more importantly, adjusting our overall strategies toward the end of yet more changing statistics matters. You know, it's basically a dishonest sales pitch that sidesteps the important conversations of what is actually working to stop climate catastrophe. And, you know, I think that basically, I mean, I'm just not convinced that making this about a numbers game to celebrate the disrupting of 25% of an industry when we've lost over 98% of the battles in a war with such high stakes, particularly when these activist campaigns have spent hundreds of millions of dollars with thousands of our relatives being jailed and dragged through the racist court systems. You know, and it's, so it's hard not to be pessimistic. But I think, again, like the point I want to get at is just like what you're saying, and I think what you also represent in this, you know, discussion, this critique is that, you know, it's not a persistent job or role. It's our responsibility. And especially when we center our lives, or at least part of our lives is in orbit to or proximity to ceremony, and we try to bring that back and connect that more around these sacred fires and so forth, or whatever teachings people have. You know, we find that assurance and understanding, and it, you know, as it's been articulated through teachers that I've had, and I don't want to just take up too much time talking about this because, again, we'll link to just the thing that we wrote about this and published. But, you know, everybody says climate change is the greatest threat to humanity. Well, it's a consequence of the war against Mother Earth. And if we don't understand things in those terms and look at the spiritual tools that we have to address these wars, because they've happened before, you know, worlds have ended before, but it's a cycle. And when you talk about futurity, you know, before we started recording in this podcast, we talked about, you know, the difference between settler futurity and indigenous futurity and the cyclical understandings of how we're connected. I think that that's part of it. And that's where we break from this idea of being the colonizer's burden. Because I mean, for me, and I think, you know, we hopefully would all agree here, I think that's why we're, you know, here sharing the space, is that we don't want an ecologically friendly settler colonial state. We seek to abolish its very existence.
Exactly. Like, you can put windmills on the cities all you want, but settler colonialism is not sustainable, and nor should it be, you know, nor can it be. And I think, like, just even just reorienting the conversation to, again, that root point of the war against Mother Earth is so critical. And just this worldview, and that comes out of these Christian, you know, these Christian, you know, the papal bulls, and like the origins of slavery, and, you know, what eventually becomes chattel slavery, and all these intersections, you know, where it's like anti-Black racism is also part of this conversation of settler colonialism that's built wealth for the settler colonial project. And it's just, you know, it's extremely, the violence is extremely intersectional, and like, so must our resistance be, you know? And I just really appreciate everything you're saying there, Clee, to ground the conversation. And yeah, I don't know. I'm very, I feel good. I feel like excited, and like some kind of embers inside of me, you know, because we have a lot of collective power, and it just goes to show that what we're doing. And like, also too, like, let's be real. A lot of that biodiversity is like, even in the Amazon, you know, you've got uncontacted nations that are striking down like Mormons, you know, by the river, like every day. And, you know, so it's like, it's so decentralized what a lot of our work is. And as, you know, Indigenous people all over the world, you know, who are protecting our traditional territories, like, it's extremely decentralized, and it's based in that responsibility, you know, for, it's that inherent responsibility, like, we have as members of a family to protect our future and protect the natural world, which gives us everything, you know, our identity, our language, our laws, our survivance, our thrivance. So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Bearcat, did you want to, I don't think you threw a shout out or call out there, anything in closing as well?
Yeah, sure. I got a little something. Well, I guess my call out would be, you know, just a big fuck you to Deb Holland, her whole crew, her whole team, whatever. I'd like to give a shout out to my sister Bear Cub. She just graduated with a team of folks that are doing Indigenous fire practitioners training up in the Pacific Northwest, where they're training to do backburns and learning how to navigate and to caretake the land with fire. And basically doing like wildland firefighting, except for in a more proactive approach and taking back mm-hmm. their ancestral roles in that way. I think it's a really cool program, and I think it's pretty badass to be out there in the, you know, out in the woods, out in the bush, doing what they do. So big shout out to their whole crew, and congratulations on all of you who have passed, and keep trying again if you didn't actually pass, because we need more people like that, and we need more people out there supporting these kind of like these people out there that are doing this work and that are working with elders of the land and taking on that responsibility. It's a lot of work. So, yeah.
Yeah, I love that controlled burning. I actually have one more call out. And this is more to this is one last call out. This is something we've been dealing with up here quite a bit, but I'm sure you all have been dealing with it. And there's two categories. Okay, so one of them, I'm going to speak, you know, obviously we all know the issue with pretendians, and we're just going to say fuck all pretendians. But also for people who are intergenerationally reconnecting, okay, who've grown up white, and even maybe even into their adulthood as white folks, and it wasn't through the foster care system that they were disconnected. You know what I mean? Like, it's not a 60 scoop, millennial scoop situation. And I'm not speaking to those like lived experiences as Indigenous people. I'm speaking to folks who are the first one in several generations. They've been intergenerationally white for several generations, and now they're starting to reconnect to an Indigenous identity. And obviously that's nation specific as to whether or not you're claimed back. But there's been a lot of discussion around this, and other people have said it before me. But I just want to add an echo to that is, like, you should not be applying to scholarships that are meant for Indigenous students. You should not be the first one lining up for funding. You should not be the first one in a leadership position. You have to be self-reflexive around your position as someone who's coming into an Indigenous identity, and that you can be extractive, exploitative, and also you can also culturally appropriate as well. And like, even within our own communities and nations, not all knowledges and protocols are open for everybody to partake in. And that even certain society, like there's initiation, there's protocol, there's process, and not everything is open to everyone. And just to kind of keep that same energy and sort of, you know, if you're someone who has grown up white and lived white your entire life, and then you find out you have Indigenous ancestry and you're doing the work to reconnect in a good way to those ties and to those family members and to your nation, and that's a reciprocal claim, you know, then like, please be also aware of your position in community, and that you should not be the first one who is getting support and having a role of leadership. And actually, to add to that, I also want to encourage folks who are entering that type of journey to ensure that they actually verify their identity and their claims before identifying. I think people tend to run with blood myths in their family. And so it's like, check your settler blood myth, like do a background check on your settler blood myth before starting identifying as Indigenous. And all too often you'll see that actually it's not always the case, you know, and especially in certain regions, there's a lot of like in the Quebecois like to think of themselves as like, whatever, you know, they're really bad for it. And anyway, all that to be said is like, you know, settlers, check your damn blood myths before you start identifying as Indigenous. And if you're like legitimately intergenerationally reconnecting, like be mindful of the power and privilege that you hold. And don't be the first one applying for funding or putting up a position of leadership. And maybe some revitalization practices should be going should be more widespread in community before you engage in them. That's my two cents.
You just started like the topic of a whole nother show that we need to dig into. We need to have you back as a guest, Amanda. So much to talk about that issue alone and so many of the other points that we've just sort of brushed on. But thank you so much for your time. Thank you, Bearcat, as well for co-hosting. I'm really excited to get back into the podcast and for all of y'all who have been waiting for us to do new shows. We are doing shorter shows. We're going to integrate video, as you see here, and we're going to keep them punchy and we're going to keep them claws out. So thanks. Thank you so much for joining us.
You can find this broadcast on any of the usual podcast platforms or at indigenousaction.org/podcast.
Email us pics of burning cop cars, burning churches, burning forts, or any questions or topics you'd like to hear us go claws out on at iainfo@protonmail.com.